This series of Let's Make It Rain is sponsored by PensionBee, a leading online pension provider. They're on a mission to make pensions simple so that customers all over the UK can become pension confident and save for a happy retirement. PensionBee's website and app make it simple for customers to combine their old pension pots, contribute flexibly, and withdraw their pension money all in one place. PensionBee offers a range of pension plans for different savings needs, from a flexible self-employed plan to socially responsible plans like their Impact Plan or Sharia Compliant Plan. Head to pensionbee.com or download the app to get started and become pension confident. Remember, when investing, your capital is at risk. And speaking of investing, you've probably heard me say before that we are our own biggest asset by far, and that includes investing in the next generation. I wrote Cash is Queen exclusively for preteen and teenage girls to equip them with everything they need to take control of their financial futures early. It's been translated into 5 languages and is available worldwide. So grab a copy for you and a friend today. Hi, and welcome to the Let's Make It Rain podcast. I'm your host, Davinia Tomlinson. This podcast is for the rainmakers. Those women who are breaking down walls, building their own empires, defying convention and rejecting stereotypes. Women who are unafraid to have open, honest conversations about money among friends and to share the truths we've been told to keep secret. Don't forget to subscribe, share and download wherever you usually get your podcasts. And if you like what you hear, then please leave us a 5-star review. Hello and welcome to the latest episode of the Let's Make It Rain podcast. Today, I'm super excited to be joined by my friend and tech powerhouse, Rashada Harry. Rashada is an enterprise technologist, founder and board trustee. And it was on a board that Rashada and I first met and then became firm friends. So Rashada, thank you so much for being here today. Why don't you tell us a bit more about you for the benefit of the listeners, and in particular, what it means to be an enterprise technologist?
Oh, firstly, thank you so much, Davinia. This has been a long time coming and it's an absolute, absolute pleasure to finally connect. So a bit about me. As you said, I'm an enterprise technologist. And what does that mean? So I joined the tech industry, 20 years ago now, and I work with customers of all size, but primarily at the moment in the enterprise space, and advise them on their cloud and digital transformation journeys. So what that looks like day to day, I talk about kind of where they're going in their business and how technology can enable them. I talk to senior executives, I talk to board members and heads of, people who are really using the tech and using it to improve their business performance, their operations, and to do it in a secure way. So that's what I do day to day along with a team. I do that at Amazon Web Services, where I'm presently employed, and I'm also a founder. So I co-founded the initiative Your Future, Your Ambition. And that was with the premise to help inspire, educate and inform young people from all backgrounds, from the age of 7 up to graduate age, into the opportunities that a career in STEAM can afford. So that's science, technology, engineering, the arts and maths. And we connect industry professionals and role models with young people who are looking to explore opportunities. And then finally, I do sit on a number of boards. So we met on a previous board that I was on. That was a great experience. So I presently sit on the board of Engineering UK, and I'm chair of the Big Bang Kick, which is another STEM fair to help inspire young people into STEM. And I'm also a trustee at the African Gifted Foundation, which supports gifted girls who want to pursue STEM education. And they're based out in Ghana. And then finally, I'm a trustee at Off the Curriculum, which helps to really galvanize kind of STEM learning into practice and putting it out there for everyone. And that's me.
Do you hear how she says, and that's me, like she's just read off her shopping list. Like, this is just my grocery shopping. Do you see what a powerhouse Rashada is and why I've been patiently waiting to get time in her diary to have this conversation? Because I thought it was so crucial that I was able to share her magic with you all as rainmakers. And so Rashada, let's get into it, because obviously you and I know one another very well. We're able to have high-level conversations, low-level conversations, all the conversations in between, you know, what it means to be a woman in business, what it means to be, I don't know, you know, a woman who's thinking about all of these different beauty regimes. We were talking about LED facials just before we started recording. So that's something that's on my to-do list to look up when I finish this conversation. But, you know, for everything that you've achieved, you wear your expertise and your credentials, if you like, so lightly. You know, you are so unassuming, so humble. And I think it's one of the most endearing qualities about you, because I remember being so incredibly in awe of you when I joined that board and thinking, wow, you know, this is a real power room. And whenever you would speak, the whole room would pause and listen to what you had to say. And I have seen that in every other sphere in which you have operated. I have had the privilege to be involved with running some workshops for the YFYA young people. And we'll get into that in a bit more detail in a moment. But even in the coordination for that, such a mammoth undertaking, I don't think anybody could ever appreciate. I mean, this woman has filled stadiums. She has filled the Emirates Stadium. Is it the Emirates Stadium?
It was, yeah. It was the Emirates.
With young people year after year. And you would never know when, you know, of course, when she enters into rooms, you feel that, okay, I'm in the presence of someone truly special here. But you would never know that she has that laundry list of credentials. And I really want to touch on one of your most recent ones. I mean, they're coming up all the time, right? But you were recently awarded Woman of the Year in Tech by Computing, which is a global publication. And I really want to delve into what that means to you, because, of course, you know, as I'm saying, my perception of you is somebody that wears your credentials very lightly. You don't ram it down our throats. You know, you barely even share it. The only reason that I know some of these things are happening is because, you know, you might post yourself looking beautiful on WhatsApp. And I'm like, oh, wow, Rashada, you look so glamorous. And then you'll say, oh, yeah, I'm just at an award ceremony. And I'm like, what? You're at an award ceremony? Like, what is going on? So you are not a LinkedIn promoter. Mm. You are not somebody that is given to self-congratulation, even though it is well-deserved. And so, you know, being awarded Woman of the Year in Tech is such a mammoth achievement, particularly by such a well-respected publication in your industry. What does that mean for you? And I suppose in particular, for somebody who is a self-described introvert, and of course, introversion, you know, we all sit on a kind of continuum from extroversion to introversion. Yeah. But I imagine it probably feels quite uncomfortable in many respects to be in the spotlight. What does that mean for you and how do you manage that?
Yeah, and I think that's a really good starting question, actually. So thank you, firstly, for the kind words. I'm sitting here thinking, oh my gosh, she's paying Davinia.
Totally true.
I think, you know, just going back to, so like awards and like, yes, I was fortunate enough to be named Woman of the Year Tech at the end of 2023, which was so, so humbling. When I look back to the tech industry when I first started, there were hardly any women. There were certainly hardly any Black women. There was very few role models. You know, 20 years on, it's really nice to be recognised for the impact and, you know, hopefully the legacy that I'm going to leave the industry with. But, you know, when we talk about kind of self-promotion and self-advocacy, yes, it's very important. I definitely encourage every person, male or female, to kind of definitely hold true to their strengths and to self-advocate as well. But I do recognise it's not easy for everyone, and I'm definitely in that camp. I'm definitely not one for the celebritising and the limelight. I love the recognition, don't get me wrong. I'm really humbled and grateful because, you know, that I know I was surrounded by amazing women also in like various categories and who also applied for those awards. But equally, I don't necessarily like the visibility. I'm one of those quiet people who likes to observe and, you know, share my feedback, but I don't have to hold the microphone. I don't have to be in the limelight all the time. And I think maybe sometimes people can kind of assume that that's possibly imposter syndrome, or it can be linked to kind of not feeling confident in who I am, or, you know, maybe I'm just not good enough for people in the room. And I think that shows up at all levels of your career, right? At all stages. You all know the kind of stories of sometimes if you say something and it's not heard, or a colleague then says it 2 minutes later and it's the best thing since sliced bread, or, you know, when you don't feel like you're given a platform to even, or the opportunity, I should say, to voice your opinions, you can sometimes feel certainly that they're not valid and therefore you go more inwards. But I will say, you know, from my experience, winning that award and being up on stage and seeing, you know, 600 people clapping, I actually cried. I have a video on LinkedIn and I actually cut it because I couldn't quite believe the emotion. It was just so overwhelming, but in a good way. And I think, you know, sometimes you do have to go out of your comfort zone and kind of share your successes and not be fearful of, you know, some people may not see it as a great accolade. Some people might think, oh, you're being self-promoting. But it's important to kind of just block out the naysayers and self-advocate and champion yourselves. And I think if you ever struggle with like imposter syndrome or not feeling like you're good enough for certain rooms, you know, it's really important to have that advocacy through your tribe of people around you. So I always encourage people, have people who really know the intricacies of who you are as a person outside of the titles, outside of the job. Who are you day to day? Who can really kind of hold you up in moments of thoughts of maybe you're not good enough, or perhaps, you know, this is a bit of a stretch for me. Lean on those people. Find those people, first of all. Make sure you're in a trusting relationship with them. And then, you know, encourage them to hold you up and hold you accountable for moments when you're not advocating for yourself, when you should be.
Rashada, that's such brilliant advice. I didn't even expect to tease out, you know, some career tips from you, but it's such brilliant advice, particularly for women. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you said something that I think is testament to, I mean, there was a word that came up that I love that I'd like to return to at the end of the conversation, which is around your legacy. But I think, you know, you described not always feeling like you have to hold the mic. And I love that turn of phrase, because I think one of the things that's testament to your character and who you are is your willingness to pass the mic. You are not a gatekeeper. You are not somebody that is trying to block other people, block other women. You know, there are these terrible stereotypes about women that are kind of gatekeeping other women, which hasn't been my experience and certainly not with you. But I think, you know, even when I think about our relationship stemming back to when we were first met on that board, you have always been so open and generous with your network. If you see or hear of an opportunity that was ever in the fintech space, you would always say, Dav, have you seen this? Dav, I think this would be good for you. When you're running YFYA, you're like, can you come and run some workshops for the children? And of course, in my mind, I'm like, anything Rashada asks me to do, I'm saying yes to. And I would always say that to you, you know, like, just say, just put me down for a yes and I'll figure it out. Figure out the scheduling, right? And I think, you know, similarly in your corporate life, mm-hmm. where your professional reputation mm-hmm. is potentially at stake,
yeah.
you would always invite me into, you know, Amazon, where there was an opportunity to do so on more than one occasion, and say, can you come and run a workshop? Because your expertise is such that I would like to share it with the rest of the Amazon network. And I don't think you can appreciate the boost that it gives someone, particularly someone like me who'd already had a career and felt quite confident in the career that I'd built, to then have to pivot into being a startup founder. And suddenly you're at the bottom of the ladder again. You're suddenly feeling unsure of yourself, uncertain. And it was people like you and others, one or two others, that demonstrated that conviction in my abilities and my talents that really made a difference in the early part of my rain check journey, honestly. So I'm really enthralled by the way that you've articulated that around passing the mic, because I think what people assume of those people that have achieved immense success, as you have, is that they've had to do it by almost isolating themselves and making sure that, you know, if there is an opportunity, that they kind of keep it to their chests, not even necessarily out of willful spite, but just because they think, well, you know, there are so few opportunities, I cannot share them around. Right. Otherwise it blocks my own blessings. Yeah. And you have demonstrated the reverse. So with that in mind, then, thinking about kind of lifting as you climb, you know, as you've climbed the career ladder, you've always been somebody to bring others along with you on that journey. And you were quite right, you know, making sure you've got a real tribe of supporters is key to that. But with YFYA, you know, as you've described it, you know, promoting inclusion in STEAM careers for, I don't even know if you could say marginalized communities, but those people that might otherwise have felt excluded from certain types of career paths.
Underrepresented, yes.
Mm-hmm. Underrepresented. Mm-hmm. Was that something that was rooted in your own upbringing,
yeah.
you know, where you grew up? Can you share for us, you know, the genesis of YFYA?
Yeah, so it was co-founded with a friend of mine, and it was really born out of the idea that, you know, when we looked at the tech industry, certainly where I was working at the time, it just wasn't representative, I should say, of the community which I grew up in, even at a local level, at school, at college, at university. So how is it that there's such a drop off or a disconnect between the experience I was having at home and in my local community to the working environment? And maybe it was partly because some people didn't have an awareness of the opportunity that was out there, or didn't see themselves within that organisation or that industry, therefore didn't think that there was a home for them there and or for their career. So it was out of that that we wanted to create that binding link between education and industry to show young people who the role models were, especially those who were underrepresented, to say to them, look, go and meet these people, have a conversation, understand what they went through or their background or how they navigated their career path. Because a lot of people think that, you know, the route into tech is just really quite linear. It's not. It's really up and down. Like I pivoted from law into tech, actually. And what people don't realize is that there's a lot of transferable skills that can take you into almost any industry. It's about how you adapt.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's about how,
and important to say.
Yeah, it's about how you adapt, how you navigate, how agile you are in your mindset and in your thinking. And it can feel overwhelming for anyone who's kind of pivoting. And you're meant to feel overwhelmed because that means that you're learning, you're expanding, you've left your comfort zone. And that was the premise of YFRA, was to give them education, exposure and experience into things that they hadn't already considered. And equally, for those who were volunteering at YFRA, we had over 300 volunteers from various different organisations. It gave them an opportunity to give those light bulb moments to another young person and pass that baton down, right? Because you've got two hands. I always say, one to help yourself and one to help someone else. And that was the premise and why it was so successful.
Oh my God, what, like every response is a mic drop moment. Why did you say you've got two hands? Brilliant. I've never heard that before, but that is excellent. So well put.
Thank you.
And I think, you know, imagine again, back to this idea of legacy, mm-hmm. the investment and the contribution you have made to those young people's lives, irrespective of the career path they ultimately go on to pursue. They are not going to forget the contribution made by YFYA and you and your co-founder in particular to investing in them and thinking them worthy of that investment in the first place. I think for lots of young people, feeling as though, you know, we have been excluded from this discourse, we don't think this kind of career path is for us, mm-hmm. whether you're a woman, whether you're from a certain ethnicity, whether you're from a certain socioeconomic group,
yeah.
you know, whatever it might look like, mm-hmm. you have basically opened the conversation to them in a way that they would have previously felt that they were locked out from being able to actively participate in. And that's so powerful.
Thank you. And just to go back to your earlier point, I forgot to answer that part of the question, was kind of where did this stem from? So when I, like I said, when I joined my previous employer, which was Cisco at the time, I joined straight out of university. I just finished my master's in law, and I wanted to kind of get some commercial acumen and business expertise, and I joined a global infrastructure and networking company, and it was a fantastic experience for me. I learned so much. I moved abroad. What I was acutely aware of was the fact that there was no one else that really looked like me. There was no black women there, certainly in the UK anyway, that I could kind of look up to for that kind of mentorship, that guidance. You know, I transitioned from law into tech, so I was like a fish out of water, so to speak. So, you know, just navigating the nuances of being an American corporate, what does open door policies look like? How do you show up? How do you bring your authentic self to work? These are the things that I just simply didn't have. And I think, you know, I want to make sure that every young person doesn't feel that way when they go into a corporate organization, or any organization, doesn't have to be corporate, but it's to find a resting place that they can be their authentic selves and really show up authentically. You know, we talk a lot about code switching and being very different at work and very different at home. I don't have, maybe I'm just too long in the tooth, but I don't have the energy for that anymore. And it's exhausting. You know, you're at work 5 out of 7 days, possibly more in some instances. You need to enjoy it. You need to be your true self, and they need to accept, and the organization needs to value what difference you bring and the diversity that you bring, diversity of thought, diversity of experiences, of connections, and how you can show up, and to make sure they're embracing that in the culture. And so I'm really encouraged by where progress is being made in that area.
Me too. I mean, I'll never forget learning about this concept, and I refer to it all the time, this concept called groupthink, which we studied at university with regard to the psychology of decision making and how people behave when they are surrounded by others. And of course, in that space, it was referring to, you know, a political decision made by the US administration at the time. And effectively, you know, long story short, it pointed to the fact that a terrible decision had been taken because all of the people around the room, I think it was a group of very similar men from a certain background, certain demographic, certain ethnicity, and nobody felt confident enough to challenge the prevailing status quo. So everybody went along with the decision, even though perhaps there were some in the room that had doubts, but they wanted to be, you know, it was so important to be part of the group norm and to maintain that group dynamic that nobody challenged the status quo. And it really reminds me, I mean, that study was done in 1972 of a decision that was, that, of course, you know, that the series of events that, you know, led to that study and that terminology groupthink had happened perhaps years, if not decades prior. And it really makes me think, you know, now in 2024, close to 50 years later, more than 50 years later, in fact, that we are still having these conversations around the importance of diversity of thought, diversity of experience, background, and everything else in terms of cultivating positive outcomes and making sure that you are getting the right sorts of results in a room. Because it doesn't mean that there is anything inherently wrong with homogenous groups coming together and problem solving, because of course there is a space for that when it comes to certain types of problems. But generally speaking, you really need to have that diversity of thought. And so what you've shared is so on point when we think about why you were so committed, felt so committed to not being the only one in the room that was different and recognizing that actually, yes, I am perhaps one of few women, certainly the only Black woman here, mm-hmm. but that needs to change. And what can I do to be part of the response to changing that?
Yeah. And I think it's also about how we show up. And how, when we do engage, how we're engaging, right? So I'm big on data. I'm big on facts. Maybe it's from my legal background. I'm also big on context. So, you know, sometimes going into spaces when you are the only one, you know, you can sometimes feel like, oh, I've not got much value to add here. Let me just sit and observe. And there's nothing wrong with observing, by the way. But what I do think is when you are going to speak and you are going to present, you're presenting with context, you're presenting with facts, you're going to add value to the conversation, and you're going to make sure you're contributing actively, not just passively, to any of the group decisions that are being made. And you know, it's sometimes being comfortable being uncomfortable and asking those questions that, you know, sometimes aren't being thought about or possibly are assumed, but from a different perspective, and perhaps just sharing, well, what could the group possibly think about this alternative option? Have we thought about this? And I think being that critical friend, and you see that a lot on boards as well, is that, you know, you're looking at a state of facts, you've got to advise, you know, either the executive and be that critical friend, but to do so in a way that's working for the organization and for the prosperity of that team, not just for the individual. So yeah, I'd like to just add that in.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that, you know, that's perhaps one of your greatest strengths from my perspective in observing you, your ability to, I mean, you're effectively a giant of critical thinking. You leave no stone unturned when it comes to your analysis. And I have seen you in very difficult board conversations where we're having to hold the management and executive team to account. We're having to challenge decisions that have been taken. We're having to reflect on how those decisions have been received in the public eye. And you've been very considered, very controlled in your response, but ultimately compassionate and empathetic, which I think is a difficult line to straddle, because I think sometimes when you are challenging, I mean, you are somebody that is so well versed in just, you know, it's just come so naturally to you to be a critical thinker, that can sometimes, and particularly when it's delivered by certain types of individual, come across as quote unquote aggressive or too hard or cold. And you find a way to do so in a way that ultimately the person on the receiving end of it, at least in my estimation, could never feel that it was being delivered out of any kind of malevolent intent, but instead with the intention to improve the outcome for everyone, to make sure that everyone has considered everything and that we're being comprehensive in our deliberations, which I suppose brings me on to my next question, because you've touched on it a couple of times and I've got two, it's a two-parter, right? Because you said so much. But when we think about being Black women in leadership, and I've shared before my experiences, I always felt like I was showing up as a Black unicorn, and I very much relished that, you know, my time in the investment management industry, recognizing I was one of few women on the graduate program when I started that year. I was the only Black person. It was a very similar picture on the trading floor, in boardrooms, in meetings, where I always, you know, would make sure that my voice was heard. But finding a way to do that and really finding my feet took me a little while to figure out what is the best way to articulate myself without being viewed in a particular way? And that's a difficult thing to do for a young woman anyway, when you're entering into rooms in which there are lots of senior people, lots of male senior figures as well. I'm feeling like, you know, I don't necessarily fit, but you're trying to carve out space for yourself anyway. How have you navigated that as somebody that is, of course, a very senior Black woman, not just in tech, but in business in general and on boards? How have you navigated that perception? Because I think on the one hand, it's not our problem what other people think of us, right? We want to show up as our authentic selves and be our best selves in any space in which we occupy. But at the same time, we know that there is that barrier at times in terms of how we are received. How have you navigated that for anyone listening that might be struggling with that?
So firstly, I think it's different for everyone. There's no one correct way. I think what you have to do is just take parts that are aligned to your values and who you are and that are comfortable for you in any situation. So there's no one size that fits all. What I have found that's helped me in particular in navigating the situations is that I've got two ears and one mouth. So I listen twice as much as I speak often enough. But what I do make sure is that I am really critically looking at, not with a critical eye, but critically looking at the landscape and the dynamics of the room. I understand kind of where people's interests are. I really do pride myself on my ability to kind of hyper collaborate. And I do that through building trust with individuals, either one-to-one, you know, or in a group setting. And I think, you know, often kind of being perceived in a way that you know isn't true to who yourself can sometimes be quite debilitating and quite hurtful if that's not how you want to be known, and you know deep down that's not who you are. And I think, you know, sometimes you have to just ignore the naysayers. And I've said that as well. Sometimes you have to know who you're taking your advice and your feedback from and know to ignore it, because you're the one who's got to live with yourself 24/7, right? You know yourself. So sometimes, you know, take feedback, hear it, but take the bits that you think are relevant to you, and you have to ignore the rest, because some people just say some really just obscure and just crazy stuff that is just not asked for and not relevant to your journey. And I found that being really authentic and honest about that has really helped me build trust. I feel like when I've been in situations where I feel like it's a bit more confronting, I've just been really transparent. I tend to smile quite a lot. That's just my nature. But I'm just really transparent about where my thought process is. But I do it on the basis that I'd like us to get to a common ground. This is my perspective. I'm open to hearing yours. I'd like to learn more and help me understand your viewpoint so that we can see how we can collaboratively and together get to a point where we're both happy. I feel that works really well. I mean, there's going to be some times where you're going to come up against people who you just don't gel with. You just don't get on. You know, that's not to say they don't have value. That's not to say they don't have a perspective that you can learn from. But I think it's about prioritizing the key stakeholders, knowing how you navigate those relationships and doing what you say you're going to do. If, for example, you know, you're on a board and you're in a working environment where you're working with new people for the first time, you're not quite gelling, maybe just have a reset and just say, look, can we just reset on kind of the expectations you have of me? This is where my perspective is. I'm happy to take on this, this, and this to help us get to here. Can you share what you would like to do? And then, yeah, let's regroup and let's just see how this works out. And let's continue talking. I think communication is absolutely key. And I definitely think, you know, as I said, having that network of people to really help hold you accountable and to really help champion you when you're not in the room, especially, is absolutely invaluable. But equally, if you ever see someone who is struggling, don't allow them to struggle by themselves. I think there's a special place in hell for women or people who don't help other people, and you can see that they're struggling. Make sure that you are, you know, at least providing them with a platform, an opportunity to speak to you one-to-one, say, look, this is what I'm struggling with. Have you got a view? And just ask them. And sometimes they might not want the help. That's okay too. That's okay. Everyone's on their own journey, but make sure that you're at least being open enough to offer the help and open enough to receive feedback, but take it based on your own journey.
Rashada, it's like gem after gem. You're so full of wisdom. And I think, like, Honestly, and you've still got so many more years to go in your career. And I'm like, you know, all of the wisdom that you've acquired, all of that knowledge that you've acquired over the course of the last 20 years is so immense. I mean, even as you were speaking, and I'm not even going to be able to capture all of the themes, but what I heard was hyper collaboration. So you're working in partnership with other people, not thinking about, well, this is my section and that's somebody else's section, and we're just going to do it in isolation of one another. Hyper collaboration. I love that. Anything that looks like you're doing it at pace, you're doing it on speed, you're iterating as you go, and being agile and nimble in your responsiveness. Absolutely love that. But the thing for me, trusted relationships, when I think about the Rainmakers and the Rainmaker community and all of the work that we do to pour into one another and help one another remember, you have everything that you could possibly need to unlock your own economic empowerment. You don't need me, Davinia, to empower you, right? But what we are going to do is to hold one another up, to hype one another, and to remind one another that we have achieved great things already, specifically from a financial perspective, and that we have everything that we need to go on to achieve great things in future, based specifically on our unique journeys, as you talked about. But, you know, you talked about the transparency. And I think for anyone listening, particularly those of us, I mean, actually applies at any stage in our career, we might feel that, and I'm sure lots of us listening will have had those experiences where we're like, I can't reveal or betray any kind of weakness in this space. I don't feel psychologically safe in this space, because when I have revealed a weakness about myself, it could be something's going on at home and I've shared it with someone and they have betrayed my trust, and now it has compromised my career prospects and I'm being blocked for opportunities. Or it could be, you know, I've revealed that I'm a bit unsure about this aspect of my job and that's been used against me in a really negative way. And so that transparency, you know, you've talked about surrounding yourself with the right people, surrounding yourself with the right network. Of course, we will all have our personal networks, but having a professional network and advocates, as well as mentors and sponsors within the organization within which we work, who can hold us up, who are speaking our names in rooms in which we are not present, exactly as you said, so that when we're unable to advocate for ourselves, someone else, as you had said before, you've passed the baton to someone else and you're like, I can't do it, but they can do it for you. They can lift you up and they can say, no, Dav's got this. If there's a naysayer in the room that's like, yeah, Dav's probably got it, but she probably needs one or two more years of experience, your person in the room will be like, no, she's got it today. Give it to her today, right? And I have had those people in my career. And so I can personally attest to the immeasurable impact they have had in terms of my career trajectory. So thinking about, you know, and I loved what you said about, you know, not watching other people struggle. Oh my gosh, basic humanity. But we lose it, don't we, in a professional space?
Sometimes.
We feel like, well, it's all about me. And you're right, sometimes there are those people that are already doing this. But reminding people, you don't leave your humanity at the door when you walk through, you know, the sliding doors of the corporate world, when you get off the tube, when you work, you know, you enter into your workspace, wherever that workspace is, you remember your humanity. It's so, so key.
I think as a leader as well, it's really important to understand it's not about you, it's about the collective. I think, you know, as I kind of reflect on kind of my journey as a leader and things that I've had to expand and change my mindset on, it starts with, oh, you know, you as a leader. But actually, leadership isn't about me. Leadership is what I enable, is what I support, how I encourage, how I lift up. And I think, don't think you have to be senior to be a leader. That's the first mistake I made. I thought, oh, I have to be at this level and therefore then I'm going to be recognized. No. You're a leader the day that you start entering the workforce. You're a leader when you're collaborating with others. It's how it's around your values and how you can impart and support other people and how you can be strategic in that approach to make it scale. That is what the gem of it is. But I think more importantly, and as I said, looking and reflecting on my own journey, it's about the empathy. I am big on empathetic leadership and showing up properly in a way that is open, transparent, and integral to my own values. And I feel like, you know, you can be within a company, organization, or a culture, but you're still going to be who you are. So you'll take that to your next place, but you're going to learn nuggets along the way. So don't think that because you're not a senior exec, or you're not a VP, or, you know, whatever the title is that you aspire to be, right, that you're not a leader today. You absolutely are, and you absolutely are a role model. So you can be an advocate, you can be a sponsor at any stage in your career for someone else.
I love that. It's like the Rainmaker's Guide to showing up as your authentic self and recognizing that, you know, as we always say, you are your own biggest asset by far, and that you already have intrinsic gifts and intrinsic qualities that could help somebody else. There are people watching you that you don't even know are watching you, that are ultimately inspired by you, and, you know, that are seeking to emulate your success. And so the best gift you could give them is to remind them that they are already leaders in their own respect. And so ultimately they're just building on a solid foundation that they perhaps already cultivated. But speaking of that solid foundation, Rashada, I'm very interested to kind of dig a bit more deeply into the career moves that you've made, because honestly, I feel like you could write a book, and perhaps that's coming next. A book should perhaps come out of this, you know, about, you know, Rashada Harry's guide to being a career baddie. You know, this is how you build a winning career in, you know, irrespective of the industry. It doesn't have to be unique to tech or law or, you know, the boardroom or anything like that. But these are some of the things that you need to consider. Where did that come from for you? Was it a lot of trial and error? Were you very intentional? Because you sound like someone that leads with intention about your career moves. You talked about completing your master's and then thinking, I want to develop some commercial acumen for my career. I'd like to find out more about business. You didn't go into a pure law background, you know, instantly. But of course, all of the training you received by virtue of that, you know, that legal exposure has helped you, I'm sure, in the many career moves that you've made to date. Where does your career playbook come from? You know, what were some of the steps that you've taken?
Yeah, and I think I was thinking about this the other day, just randomly as you do on a Sunday afternoon. I was thinking, like, it's so funny. I started off being really intentional because I thought, because I was doing law, I was like, I'm going to be a technology lawyer. That's it. Right. But what I didn't kind of anticipate when I was younger is that markets change, environments change, industries change, skill sets, requirements change, and you have to pivot. And so I feel like whilst I was really intentional initially, I kind of fell into tech due to curiosity. I've always been quite curious about things, the mechanisms, how things work, how people think, the psychology of decision making. I feel like I've worked quite hard to kind of hone in my skill of understanding what's not being said in certain situations. And I felt like I've not in a kind of insincere way, but just way to help me understand the dynamics and people and relationships and how it works. And I think it's stood me in good stead in a business context. So those pivots that I've made, while somewhat intentional, have also been unintentional, because I couldn't have anticipated how the industry would change, right? So I wanted to be a technology lawyer. I did my thesis on the patentability of computer software. Doing my master's, as you do. I mean, I don't know how.
I love that.
I mean, that's not even. I look back and think, what was I thinking? But I really enjoyed it. And that kind of sparked my curiosity into intellectual property, then into tech, then into kind of solutions, and then solving problems and working backwards from those problems. And that's how my career in sales have kind of like transformed that kind of narrative of actually now being like a leader who kind of inspires and engages at board level on kind of big world problems, big, you know, big solutions. How do we galvanize interest? How do we innovate? How do we stay agile? How do we stay thinking about our next problem that we want to solve with tech? And how do we make sure that's an enabler? So I think it's through curiosity. I think it's by asking a lot of questions and not being afraid to ask the silly ones. And I don't think there was ever a silly question, right? If I don't know, I don't know. And you don't know what you don't know. So it's best to just ask anyway. And you never know kind of where those conversations will lead. So I've always been someone who likes to learn and continue to grow and develop, but also to challenge myself. As I mentioned, you know, it's sometimes in the world of tech, it can be really overwhelming. Like there's always a new product. There's always a new technology coming out. There's always a new kind of way of working, and it's sometimes like, God, I've just got over the last one, give me a break. But actually, I realized, as I mentioned before, you're meant to feel that way, because it means that you're learning, you're expanding, you're growing, you're leaving your comfort zone, you're going into new areas, you're getting new skills, you're garnering new insights, you're sharing better practice, you're getting the good practice, you're scaling that. So, and you're failing as well, because there's been many failures. I don't, you know, my career path has not been all, you know, great from A to B. There's been back to Z, over to G, up to H, and then back to Y. And it's been a process, but it's been one where I've definitely taken thoughts around failure and change that into positive. So whilst I failed, I know that I didn't like that feeling, but therefore I've learned from it. So I now know what I don't want to do going forward, but I've given it a go. And I, you know, I failed miserably, but I've bounced back quicker because I've learned quickly and I've recovered quickly. And I think the more you fail, the more you learn, and the more you develop and the more you grow. So
I love that, Rashada, particularly what you shared about, I'm glad you mentioned about the failure, mm-hmm. because again, it's not that we instinctively as humans want to see other people fail, well, not at least in from my perspective, but I think it humanizes others, particularly those we admire. Mm-hmm. We put people on a pedestal, mm-hmm. and sometimes, I mean, for some of us, you know, we put people on a pedestal, and if we see any sign of weakness in them, we feel uncomfortable because we think, no, I need you to be perfect because I'm so imperfect and I aspire to be like you. And for me, if being like you is ironing out all of my imperfections. But the reason it's so powerful as a statement, and for leaders like you, inspiring leaders, to say that to those people that are coming up through the ranks that are looking to you for guidance, is that it normalizes the idea that our path to success doesn't have to be a linear one. Exactly as you say, you're dancing around the alphabet, like what the hell is going on here? But in addition, you're getting up, like you're learning from it. You're not getting up and doing the same thing that just had you on your back, you know, 5 minutes ago. You're getting up and going, oh my gosh, well, what can I do differently to avoid that? Because I can't drive through that pothole again. Or it's thinking, right, these are the moves that I want to make. And actually, it might require me to take a backward step temporarily in order to take several steps forward in a new industry, in a new career. And I think, you know, for lots of us, and I think this is shifting, I definitely see evidence that this is shifting, but certainly for our generation, Rashada, you know, the millennials, where for women like us, you know, girls like us, who perhaps were trained, and perhaps, you know, and particularly those that come from an immigrant background, were conditioned to believe you have to be right all the time. You have to be perfect all the time. The idea of doing anything that is, you know, less than 100%, it's not okay. So there isn't, we don't really give ourselves any scope or wriggle room to make those mistakes. We feel that we've got to cover up a mistake, right? We're just not, there's no self-compassion. We're so hard on ourselves and we're hard on other people. And so what I like to see with this new generation and you in using all of your skills, all of your experience and sharing it so generously with them, it's helping them to be a much more emotionally resilient and emotionally more secure generation, where they will call out things that they feel, they will call out discrimination in the workplace. They will push to effect change from a policy level. They are not just going to accept the status quo. And I love that for them, the young men as well as the young women. I think it's a brilliant thing.
Yeah, it's very courageous. And,
you know, it is. Mm. So when I think about just coming back to women on boards then, because, you know, there's been this big debate, not just in the UK, but elsewhere, about how do we get a higher concentration of women on boards? Back to the point about the groupthink that I described previously. And as you shared, the importance of diversity, of experience, of thought, of all of the different things, background, education, etc., and how that makes for richer outcomes. What advice would you have for anyone, women in particular, that are perhaps slightly daunted by the prospect of joining a board? And maybe we do this thing, don't we, where we say, well, I'm not ready to join a board. Like, what? Why would I be considered for a board? You have to be, let's say, for example, a white man in his 50s or 60s. No disrespect to white men in their 50s or 60s, right? Because the point of the diversity is not that we are trying to erase or eradicate any demographic. The point is that we're promoting greater inclusion. But still, there are those people, women especially, that might think, being on a board is not for me, not for someone of my age, my background, my ethnicity, my gender. How do we change that mindset? And I suppose encourage more women to throw their hat in the ring, because I often say, and again, you know, back to the rainmakers, I often say it's as much personal responsibility as it is the industry and institutions transforming. We have to be those agitators for change. Otherwise, there's no incentive for them to change necessarily. We've got to be the change. We've got to push. We've got to self-advocate. And we want them to do the right thing. But if they don't, we've got to keep banging on the door.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. What would you say to those women that are thinking that maybe toying with the idea of joining a board, or perhaps hadn't even considered it because they think it's not for them?
Yeah.
What would you say?
I would definitely say it's been an invaluable, game-changing, eye-opening, skills-building experience being on a board. And I've been on the board of large charities from various different industries, from theatre to engineering, in the tech capacity, social and community groups. So don't think you have to go straight for a commercial board. You don't have to. You can start with a smaller local organisation who really would be helped by the expertise you're going to bring. So whatever discipline you may be in, right? You could be a nursery nurse, but you have knowledge and an interest in safeguarding, for example. That is going to be invaluable to a charity who are working with young people, right? You might be someone who leads a lot of projects within your organization, right? And therefore you have a big view on risk and profile and how implementing different solutions for your organization has been beneficial. You could be a great advisor to a smaller organization or a medium or a large one who are thinking about their digital transformation and some of the key risks they need to be considerate of, or from a security perspective, what they should be thinking about. It's all about how open you are to sharing your insights and your knowledge, how open you are to listening to different perspectives around the table. And I would say to any woman, go for it. I feel like there's not enough. But what I will do is challenge every person that is on a board or who joins a board to make sure you're creating space for other people to join the board, right? Who don't look like you, who don't come from the background that you come from, to really challenge your own thinking and being that critical friend to the executive team, to the organization, to make sure they're successful. You know, I always say when I think about taking on a board role, am I able to be impactful? Am I going to help them get to their goals? Am I going to challenge them to think outside of the box and to go a bit deeper? Am I going to help them implement their strategy? And am I going to leave that place better than I found it?
I love that.
Yeah. And that's how you should always look at it. And also challenge yourself to stay relevant and to stay up to date on the current affairs of the industry and know what's going on and share a different perspective. I would definitely encourage everyone to do it.
And I think the idea of kind of flexing a different muscle for those people that, you know, you're so used to operating in your zone of excellence. Mm. And you've talked earlier in the conversation about being uncomfortable. You know, sometimes when you feel like you're being really stretched and you're like, oh gosh, this feels really uncomfortable. It's like having a pebble in my shoe. And then eventually you figure out how to shake the pebble out. You identify, oh, the reason I feel uncomfortable is because I'm walking around on this pebble. But now I've shaken the pebble out and I'm gliding around and I feel good. It's really important that we do get comfortable being uncomfortable. I know that can feel like an overused expression, but all of us will have had those experiences, those times where we're like, gosh, I'm so, like, I just can't bear it. When will this discomfort pass? And then one day you realize, wow, it's been days since I felt that discomfort, or weeks since I felt that discomfort. And now suddenly it feels like the clouds have broken and the sun's come out. I've broken through that pain barrier. That I think is really important, and we have to give ourselves permission to lean into that friction. I read a report recently that was talking about, you know, a concern about this generation. I always bristle a bit. I always feel a bit nervous or sensitive to anything that's trying to label generations as X or as Y, because of course it's a sweeping generalization. But I do think, you know, one of the central premises that could apply to any generation actually in different respects was about why it's so important that we have some friction in our lives. We need an ability to prove ourselves. We need to have a bit of pressure. We don't want it to tip over into unmanageable stress, but we need a bit of friction, because otherwise we're gliding through, you know, everything, you know, doors are just flinging open for us. It's super easy. That sounds like it would feel good, but you haven't had to test yourself and your abilities. In the end, psychologically, what the article was saying is that we all want the ability to demonstrate what we know, to demonstrate what we're made of.
Absolutely.
Right? How good do we feel when we're like, look at that. I leapt over that hurdle, didn't even think that I could do that. And you look back on yourself and you're like, wow. And I always remind the Rainmakers of this. Look back on those times where you have already climbed a mountain, got out of that terrible relationship, negotiated the better salary, invested on behalf of yourself or your kids. You've already done those things. We are just thinking about how you can fine tune or optimize what you already have within you. So I suppose before we move on from the board question, one quick thing, because it occurs to me that there are some people listening who might be unfamiliar with the role and the responsibility of a board. So when you think about what role boards occupy from a corporate governance perspective as it relates to the management team, what are boards there to do effectively?
Yeah, a board is there to oversee the efficient running of an organisation, to make sure that they are staying true to the values and the mission of what they are set up to do, and to do so efficiently and not bring the organisation or the industry into disrepute, right?
Right.
Very kind of legal answer there, but ultimately you're there to make sure it's a success and that it stays aligned to the vision and mission, right? What a board is not there to do is to do it. It's to run the organization. You're there to advise, to govern, and to advise the CEO and the executive on questions and queries they might have, but to make sure we are understanding the strategy and helping to formulate that strategy of which the organization will work towards. I feel like if you are someone who's a doer, like I'm a doer. Like I like to execute on things. When I joined my first board, I was really struggling with, why don't you just do it this way? It's so easy to do it this way. And you could just do it. And actually, I was completely wrong. That was completely the wrong approach, right? My role is to advise. I am meant to allow people to make an informed decision. So I'm there to support and advise the executive, the team, on and give my opinion. And the decision is a group decision. It's not just the Rashada way. So I feel like if you're someone who likes to help and to support bigger picture thinking and to also give challenges to the status quo about how we can do things better, then I think you can absolutely add value to the role of a person on a board or to be a trustee in an organization. I think for myself, I'm someone that holds myself to a really high standard of account. So, you know, when you are on a board, you're working alongside your colleagues and your peers who have that same standard, right? And they're going to hold you to that account, and you have to be open to that and being open to receiving that feedback. So I would definitely encourage all of your rate makers to consider it and to not limit their thinking that they can't do it because they haven't achieved this or achieved that. You've all got experiences that can add value to lots of different areas of corporate life, of charity life, of all different boards.
I love that. And I particularly love what you shared about, because I'm very similar to you in being, I'm just like, let's get to it. If I, you know, and sometimes I get really blinkered and obsessive. I'm like, well, this is the answer.
Yeah.
What? Like nobody can see me, but I'm literally here clicking my fingers like, why aren't we doing this? Let's go. Mm-hmm. And actually I've had to humble myself. Yeah. That's important too. We're learning about ourselves all the time. Similar to you, I've had to be like, oh, actually, Dad, no, you're wrong. Sometimes sit back and let somebody that really knows, let them lead on it. So for anybody listening that might be, again, similar personalities to us that are, you know, deep into the execution, it's a good opportunity for you to learn how to advise. You don't always have to be in the trenches.
And just if I can add to that as well, you know, it's okay to disagree and then commit. Think about the long-term view. It's not just the Davinia show or the Rashada show. It's the us.
It's not the Davinia show?
Well, this one is, to be fair. But you know what I mean? Like, it's not just about you as an individual. It's about the collective responsibility. So I'm very okay to sit back and say, okay, that's a better approach. I might disagree with the way we're doing it, but you know what? I'm committed to making sure, if that's what we all agreed to do, that it's going to be successful. That is, I think, something that people should also consider when they're in those groups, dynamics and situations, and just how you can really demonstrate your ability to commit to that mindset, but also to collaboratively work with other people, even if you don't agree with the approach. It's very important.
I love that. I mean, it's the definition of synergy, isn't it? You know, bringing together all of these people, potentially from disparate backgrounds. Some of you might be from similar backgrounds, but ultimately it's about being greater than the sum of your parts and, you know, ultimately leading to much better outcomes. So, okay. So now I want to get into the money, Rashada, because for someone like you who has made so many power moves in your career and who has been very frank about, you know, this is where it's gone really well, Dav, and actually this is where it hasn't been great.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let us speak candidly about your personal relationship with money.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe your relationship with money, and has it evolved over time, would you say?
Yeah, I think it has. I feel like it's changed over time. I always knew that I needed money. I needed it to live for the lifestyle that I wanted, but I wasn't prepared to be working. I mean, I don't live to work. I was working to live, right? And so that informed my mindset around money and just how risky I'm going to be in relation to maybe my investments, the things that I do with my money, the things that I spend my money on, and what it allows me to have. I think the journey around money and having money confidence is really important. I mean, you can be rich based on the experiences you have that your money affords you to have, right? But you could also be very troubled if you have a lot of money. I've seen it. I've seen people who have amassed supreme wealth and they're not confident in themselves. They're not happy. It's not been something they've wanted. They don't have to appreciate kind of what they had, and they didn't use it effectively. So my kind of mindset in relation to money is to use it to build. I wouldn't say I'm overly risk averse. I'll take a couple of risks. I'm happy to kind of put something out there, but with the mindset that if I put it out there, I'm okay to lose it. And if it comes back, that's a bonus. What I would say about kind of in my experience, career-wise and with money, is negotiate, negotiate, negotiate. That is something I wasn't acutely aware of at the beginning of my career. And it's something that, you know, I've been quite open with it, you know, absolutely held me back in certain circumstances. I remember in one of my roles finding out that my colleague was earning, I think, £20,000 more than me. I was baffled. I could not understand how that happened. And I realized quite early on then it's because I didn't negotiate strongly enough on entry. And sometimes it's harder to do it when you're in a company and level up and get, you know, and get promoted and get that difference kind of closed. Actually, you need to go in all guns blazing and really see the value. And I think that comes back to valuing yourself, valuing your expertise and what you bring to the table. What I would also say around money is, you know, make it work for you. Don't see money as like the enemy. See money as something that can help you, can help your family, can create that legacy of and building of wealth for your family, for your dependents. And even if you are just, you know, by yourself or you're an individual person, think about how you can use your money for good. That's something I do personally. I give quite a lot to charity. I'm always trying to pay it forward in the literal sense for other people. So I've given quite a bit to individuals who I can see potential, who maybe don't have the resources that I have. I've absolutely supported them. And then also know when to say no in relation to money as well. Because sometimes people can have a perception of you and what wealth you have, and actually it's quite inaccurate. But maybe you just manage your bills well, you negotiate hard, but you're trying to, you know, get the best rate for your, I don't know, your gas or your electricity or whatever it may be, your mobile bill. Sometimes you have to learn about the perception that others have of you in relation to your money, because sometimes you can say, well, someone can say to you, oh, you know, you're rich, you drive this car, or you live in that property, or you go on holiday all the time, you must be rich. Actually, no, maybe I'm just good at budgeting, that I apportion X amount of my salary every year to my travel experiences, or maybe I've just not gone on holiday for the last couple of years, I can afford this vehicle, or I just prioritize my spending for the things that I want. And then I think as well, you know, sometimes you have to spend money to get money. And what I mean by that is investing in yourself. And it took me a long time to realize this, longer than I care to admit, that, you know, paying for that course, going on that retreat, that's going to help with your mental well-being, that's going to give you that time to just self-reflect to see, actually, I'm on the wrong path and I need to go for this job and I need to leave this environment to go for that one. You need to invest in yourself, and sometimes you need to pay out for that in order for you to get the value tenfold in other things.
You said something about the perception that others have of you. And we've talked before about, you know, in the Rainmaker community, and, you know, we've shared content on social media as well about money scripts and the ways in which we cultivate a relationship with money based on what we've experienced in our upbringing and childhood, but also the people, how we are socialized as adults. And it is such a risk, you know, if you are not aware of it, it is such a risk for us to succumb to the expectations projected on us by others based on what they think, right? So them looking at us and going, Rashada works for Amazon. She must have Amazon shares or options or whatever. She drives that good car. She's got that house, whatever the case may be. And in their minds, they're like, Rashada's a millionaire. You, Rashada, in contrast, might be someone that is heavily indebted. No idea, because they have no idea the ways in which you've acquired the assets that they seemingly think you have. You could be heavily indebted. You could be highly stressed. You know, you've talked about those, you know, people that you know in your professional network, perhaps in your personal network, who've amassed huge amounts of wealth, but who are struggling in other ways. And so it's really important that we remain immune to projections placed on our shoulders by others, both positively and negatively. We have to remain focused on our own self-concept. What does wealth look like for us? What is the career path that I want to pursue, even if it goes against what other people think I should be doing? And how does that impact me? I think that's so important. You've touched on it, which kind of brings me on to my next question about what does it mean to be a wealthy woman to you? Because that manifests itself differently for different people.
Ooh.
Right?
Well, I think I'll turn it back. What does it mean to be wealthy? And I think wealth is being healthy, having presence of mind, having the ability to take a step back and assess where you are. It's about being confident in your feelings of who you are, knowing yourself. It's about knowing your value. And I think wealthy is about encouraging. It's where you can encompass and when you can create a life of firsts. That's wealth to me. I love that. It's on my mood board. I'm just looking at that right now.
Creating a life of firsts.
That's what wealthy is to me. It's creating a life of firsts, or curating, I should say, a life of first experiences.
Yeah.
I love that. You know what? We need to coin that.
Wow, Rashada. Oh my gosh.
That's a little gem. That one is a gem. I've got to say.
Wow.
That one is a gem. Curating a life of firsts is wealth for me.
I don't know how we're going to create the sound bites for this episode, to be honest, because the whole episode is one big sound bite, so it's not really going to work.
Yeah.
My goodness.
Curating a life of firsts. Having that confidence, having that ability to, you know, experience the greatest of feelings for you. That's personal to you. You know, one of the things I wanted to touch back on, just from your last point, right? I think as a Black woman and as Black families, and I'm sure it's similar in other cultures, right? We don't often talk about the Black tax. Can we talk about that, please?
Let's talk about the Black tax. Hello.
Can we talk about it just for a second and what that means? You know, I'm the firstborn in a family. Sometimes there's expectations on the firstborn that, you know, when you grow up in a household and you start your first job, you give your parents their keep. Right? You've got room and board. You know, they're paying for electricity, gas, water, food on the table, Wi-Fi nowadays. How are you paying it back to your family that have helped raise you, educated you, clothed and fed you? And what does that look like in reality? And when does that stop? Or does it ever stop? And what does that look like in our social settings, in our communities? And when we think about wealth, I think that's something that's equally important. I'm sure it's very similar in other cultures as well, but that is something that I know is prevalent within our culture as a Black community.
Definitely. And I think, I mean, even when you look at remittances as a proportion, as a contributor to GDP in many, you know, African and Caribbean countries, it accounts for a hefty portion, you know, the money that we are sending back home, particularly those of us that are first, you know, my parents were first generation immigrants. So, you know, I'm the second, the eldest of the second generation. Same. And, you know, whilst, to be honest, full disclosure, because I don't want any of my cousins or my aunties or uncles listening to this going, what the hell is Dav talking about? Like, she's such a pampered princess. That is true. That said, I certainly watched, you know, my parents and my grandparents who had a commitment and retain that commitment to this day to siblings that were left back
home,
to other family members that might have moved back home. And it's an expectation that never leaves. And if you think about, you know, I've been very interested in epigenetics and how, you know, certain things become embedded in our DNA and how, you know, despite our relative upward mobility as we, you know, move to the UK, move to the US, we always retain, if not a sense of guilt, but that sense of duty and obligation.
Absolutely.
And I think it works both ways. It can be both positive and negative, and there's definitely a lot of upside to investing in your community.
Yeah.
But when you think about your own wealth creation prospects for your own legacy and your own generations to come, that's really where you start to feel like, gosh, is this going to become an impediment to my wealth building aspirations? So I'm so glad that you brought that up. I feel that is a podcast in itself, but I'm glad you mentioned it for those people that wouldn't be familiar otherwise.
Yeah.
So, Rashada, for my final question then, I want to talk about how you've effected transformational change. And I mean, really, this entire episode has been about the many ways that you are just showing up as a rainmaker in everything that you do, all of the different rooms and spheres within which you operate. But this is a podcast about making it rain. And I often think that for the rainmakers listening, it's really inspiring to hear from other women about how they've affected transformational change and what that looks like for them based on their own sheer grit and determination, you know, the ways that their magic is just out there in the world and how, you know, you're raining down this glitter in every room that you move in. Can you share an example of when you have made it rain in your life and why it's made you particularly proud?
Oh my gosh.
I bet you've got loads of examples. I know it's such a big question.
I can't think. I've got so many. No, I can't even think. Like, that's just how my mind. I'm struggling. Oh my gosh. I think it's YFYA. I think it's Your Future, Your Ambition. I think it's the fact that we've helped to mentor and inspire over 12,000 young people globally. I think that's got to be it. I think it was just an idea. As it's meant to be, I tell you, the backstory of that is it was meant to be a one-off event in light of the 2012 Olympics. It was meant to be a one-off event. And we had the CEO of National Grid at the time come to the event. We had like 200 kids locally come. And he was so inspired. He said, you have to do this again. And when the CEO of a big public company calls you to account in front of everyone, you know what you got to do. And I'm an executor. And, you know, we continued it. We did it right through the pandemic. But it's actually just those light bulb moments and seeing the sparks of interest happen, seeing the mentors get so much from the mentees even. You know, hearing stories of people coming back to me years later and saying, do you know what, I came to YFYA and now I'm working in engineering, or now I'm doing this and now I'm doing that. And just hearing the journeys, I think it's the impact. I hope that's answered your question, but that's it for me that kind of resonates.
That has more than answered the question. 12,000 young people, Rashad. You know, again, back to the start of this conversation, we talked about legacy. And if that is not legacy dressed up with lipstick on, tied in a bow, then I'm sorry, I don't know what legacy is. What an incredible contribution, and one that already will reap rewards for innumerable generations to come, because in planting the seed with the top tier generation, the ones that, you know, had the privilege of being able to be part of YFYA, their children, their grandchildren, the footing that you have set for them is not a footing that will remain with them. It sets the foundation for future generations.
But I will say as well, Davinia, it wasn't just me. It took a village. Right. It takes a village to raise a child. That is the premise of which we started it, right? It takes a community of people, a community of different at one point we had about 36 different organizations, from big blue chip organizations to small community grassroots organizations, all coming together. I mean, you saw it at the event, right? We had people like Deloitte, GlaxoSmithKline, Cisco, National Grid, Adobe, got Bloomberg, you know, and you know, City of London Police, University of Cambridge, all coming together with a common goal of helping to inspire. And, you know, the 300 and so mentors, the core team, the people that did this outside and outside of their day jobs and above and beyond, right? This is weekends. This is evenings. This is like passion project on on speed, right? This is just because we were passionate about making a difference. We wanted to have that impact, right? And we wanted to, even if we inspired one person, that was job done for us. We were very happy with that. But the fact that we continued, and let's be honest, the pandemic was not fun. We pivoted from an in-person, 1,000 young people at the Emirates Stadium to 60 sessions online in one day.
and global.
Right? So I feel like hats off to the team, to all of us, to all the volunteers, to people who have volunteered their time, to the companies, and to the teachers and the parents who allowed the young people to come along. It's been great. So it's going to come back in a different form. We're taking a bit of a break at the moment, but it will return. And that's, I think, going to be my legacy.
Rashada, honestly, it's such a beautiful way to end this session. Honestly, if that's not the epitome of lifting as you climb, I don't know what is. Thank you so much for sharing your talents, your many, many gems. I hope that people return to this episode time and time again, because as I say, and I'm really not just saying this to gas you up, there are so many gems in there as to what a winning blueprint or playbook might look like for how to mastermind a successful career. And it doesn't have to mean that your career maps in the same way as Rashada's, but just the lessons around how you might navigate and engineer your own playbook, I think are really key.
Yeah, I'm going to leave your rainmakers with something that my mentor told me, a lady called Ginny Clark. And I went to her a couple of years ago and I said, look, Ginny, I'm really struggling with this. What do you do when you get that feedback that maybe you're not doing something in the right way or you're putting that pressure on yourself? And she said something that really changed the game for me, and I hope it helps someone else, which was always be open to feedback. Ignore the naysayers, as I said before, right? But remember how good you are. Always remember how good you are. There we go.
Boom.
I wanted to just leave you with that.
What a mic drop. Rashada, thank you so much for your time here today. Because I know everyone's going to want to connect with you and find you, perhaps support YFYA in its new incarnation when it comes back. So where can people connect with you and find out more?
So certainly I'm on LinkedIn. Dr. Rashada Harry is me. I'm also on Instagram at Rashada Harry, I think is my handle. Let me just check. Make sure it's not dot Rashada Harry, but it's Rashada Harry. I think there's only one of me. You'll be able to find me on there. And it's at YFYA UK on all other social media platforms. So yeah, you can absolutely connect, reach out. Let me know your thoughts on this podcast. And if we should do a book, maybe we should co-author a book, Davinia.
I mean,
I feel like there's a book in us.
That's a no-brainer. I'm down.
I feel like that would be something we can continue this with. So yes, my handle on Instagram is Rashada.Harry, H-A-R-R-Y.
Rashada, thank you and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
Hi everyone, Davinia here. I hope you've enjoyed today's episode. If any of what you heard resonated and you'd like to find out more about how Raincheck is helping women all over the world build sustainable long-term wealth, then visit our website at raincheck.com and join the mailing list for more commentary, tips and opinion on how you can start taking steps to leveling up your financial well-being today. You can follow us on social media at Raincheck, and don't forget to share, like, rate, review and subscribe. See you next time.